And Richard Hoagland with us, sharing his pre-Thanksgiving night with us. Well, now we're into Thanksgiving morning for most time zones, by the way. We're going to come back, talk a little bit about some of these artifacts that he spotted on the surface of Mars. And then let's also get into his question about what if JFK lived. Next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back, Richard Hoagland with us. So, Richard, knowing you as I have for the past 100 years or so, you key in a lot on artifacts on Mars or the moon as opposed to living creatures or creatures that may have died and fossilized, right?
Well, the fossilization process is very selective. Out of hundreds of thousands of species or creatures in a species that live, you may get one or two preservations. And then, depending upon what happens in the environment, they're more than likely destroyed rather than preserved. So, you know, the fossilization record is an incredibly tiny slice of the litany of living things and creatures and species that have lived on this planet. And if you extend that science to other planets where the conditions are much more extreme and the process would be much more hit and miss, the idea that we can land in a random spot on Mars and in the space of, you know, a year plus, see image after image of what people are claiming are fossilized little living organisms that just happen to have a very bad hair day, it just doesn't hold up. Now, if you're dealing with technology, if you're dealing with machines, if you're dealing with lots and lots and lots of stuff, then if you land in the right place, and Gale Crater from our model is the right place, then, yeah, there's going to be all kinds of things preserved from the floods, from the earthquakes, from the deposition events, from the subsequent erosion. And depending upon where the rover wanders, you're going to see almost like rock strata where the youngest things are on top and the oldest things are on the bottom. You're going to see a stratification of technologies or technology exposed through erosion going back through time, and they sent Curiosity to the deepest place they could after they landed pretty close to it. So there, the things we're seeing have been eroding out of a very low layer, and then the other things they've seen much later in the mission after the, you know, year plus they've been there, you know, on the ground now, are at a higher level, and we haven't even gotten to the good place yet. As we get closer to this huge mountain, which our model is not a mountain, it's an artificial structure, ancient beyond possible imagination, produced by a technology which would appear like magic, as Arthur C. Clarke used to say, my dear friend Arthur, any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. As we get closer, if they give us real data, which I think they're going to because they're kind of backed themselves into the political corner, and there's a lot of other players that someday are going to go to Mars and find out if they didn't tell us the truth.
Well, that's right.
I think the imagery and the objects in the imagery are going to get even more amazing. But as you can see from what I put up on the website, even now there is a litany of objects that in no way, shape, or form are just rocks.
And why do they seem to be scattered all over the place, almost as if they blew up or something?
Well, remember, in this model, they're very, 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 very old. And if you have something that's geologically very, very old, and in this case I'm talking millions of years, even on a pretty quiet planet like Mars, a lot can go on if you have a time window of millions of years, not the least of which are, you know, impacts, which tend to blow things up and toss them around. And so you could have objects you're seeing in the field of view that have sailed in and crashed and been buried in the sands and then uncovered by atmospheric episodes of erosion that came from, you know, a dozen miles away from some impact after Mars lost most of its atmosphere and, you know, asteroids were able to crash relatively unhindered through what's left, which is a very, very thin, you know, covering of atmosphere. So the randomization of what we're seeing in the images now doesn't bother me. What's really intriguing, and I have not yet put this together at the end of part two of the series we're doing on Enterprise on this called All It Takes Is One White Crow to Prove All Crows Aren't Black, meaning
that's right.
You only got to have one artifact to prove that NASA's been lying all these years.
That's what I tell Linda about crop formations, Richard.
Yep.
You know, she gets upset when you know, people tell her, you know, maybe 20% are unknown. I say, Linda, all you need is one.
Exactly. Well, who was it, Kehoe, back in the 50s when the...
Donald Kehoe.
Donald Kehoe, when the Marine, I think it was a colonel, founded NICAP, the first UFO organization, political grassroots organization, and his statement to the press at that time was, all we need is one, which is bona fide extra, you know, unidentified flying object, as opposed to a weather balloon or misidentified airplane or whatever. So yeah, and of course then the argument goes to the level of evidence to produce the one white crow, because the skeptics, no matter how much evidence you produce, they'll always claim that you haven't produced enough. I mean, they keep moving the goalposts, so politically it's a losing proposition to try to even argue with them because they're not honest. What you want are a group of real skeptics who will balance and weigh evidence objectively and will look at how the evidence comes down. So what I did, just randomly, I selected four images taken during the last year plus of Curiosity on Mars, and I'd be interested to know how many unusual things you can see in these objects, in these images.
Is it possible, and let's assume these artifacts are indeed what they are,
But let's assume that they're not natural.
Let's just say they're not natural, okay? And when you talked about an advanced civilization, what are the odds that that advanced civilization came from planet Earth billions of years ago?
Well, that's not really very likely given what we know of the history, the geological history of the Earth. The more probable scenario is that if we're looking at artifacts from really, really ancient times, they're indigenous Martian artifacts, that Mars had a history, which the evidence is now building. Remember, we've gone from water to environments that could house microbes, where you could drink the water, where life from Earth would be very happy and wouldn't know it had ever been translocated from one planet to another. So they're building the case to someday tell us, maybe, that there were intelligent life forms indigenous to Mars. But even if that was not the case, as I said in Monuments of Mars, you know, 30-some years ago, you could make the case that someone could have come from another star system to this solar system, traversed the distances between the stars, maybe a colonization effort, and because of the likelihood of a planet more similar to their own being a Mars than an Earth, they chose Mars to inhabit and colonize and not the Earth. And so we're looking at an extraterrestrial implant in this solar system from some other place. Again, this is all informed speculation. And when I started doing this, you know, back in the 80s when I finally published the Monuments of Mars, we had zero data that there were any other solar systems in the galaxy, right? And now we've got over 1,000 planets plus half a dozen Earth-like worlds spotted by both ground-based and the Kepler space mission, so that we know solar systems are not rare and far between. They're incredibly commonplace. What is really interesting, George, is that in all that mainstream data about all those planets out there circling all those stars, it turns out that this solar system is, and I'm going to say it, and then I'm going to say it again so you really get it, this solar system is scientifically unique. Let me repeat that. From all the other solar systems now they've cataloged and the planets they've looked at and the orbits they've calculated, this solar system, with the small rocky planets hugging the sun and the big gas giants far, far away, beginning with Jupiter at half a billion miles from the sun, appears to be unique. And they haven't touched this conundrum yet, The various papers say things like the solar system cannot be used as a model for planet formation in the galaxy. Oh, really? Well, what's one possibility for us living in a place, George, that was unique, that is unique? Somebody designed it. And no, I don't mean God, because the dating is well after the formation of the solar system, when the kind of technology that I'm envisioning, you know, Kardashev and Michio Kaku's Type 2 civilization, could literally have used anti-gravity technology, just like LeVayolet documents in his Secrets of Anti-Gravity Propulsion book, to literally move planets around, rearrange the solar system, and make of this whatever kind of cosmic garden for whatever kind of intelligent creatures these guys may have wanted. And if that's the case, if we're looking at the remains of a Type 2 civilization, then an awful lot of Mars is going to have an awful lot of ancient junk in an awful lot of places, particularly if you go to the right place. And my model is that NASA chose Gale Crater because it is the right place, and it's only a matter of time until they have to tell us the truth, however they want to politically spin it. And that time is, I would say, sometime within the next 3 years.
You sure do make us think, Mr. Hoagland.
You sure try
to make us think. This Kennedy email that you sent me, it was kind of interesting to me, where you were speculating on what might be going on with the space program had Kennedy lived.
Well,
tell me about that.
It is such a speculation that I really need to do a paper on it, and I was going to do the paper, and you kind of jumped the gun and wanted me to do a show, so I figured we'd give people a preview, but it's going to be part of the sequel to Dark Mission that I'm working on called The Heritage of Mars, Remembering Forever, which is a takeoff on my first book, The Monuments of Mars, A City on the Edge of Forever. But I've been thinking about this a lot in the last few weeks when I saw a reference to Jeff Greenfield's book, If Kennedy Lived. Jeff Greenfield, if you don't know who he is, he's a mainstream political pundit. He's got a current show on PBS. He's been at CBS, one of my alma maters, at ABC, at CNN. He's a really sharp guy, and one of the things he likes to do is to do political novels based on the what-if premise.
And he's a pretty good expert with the Kennedys.
And he's a damn good writer.
Yeah, he is.
So what he's done is to write a fictional novel of what would have happened if that day in Dallas things had been a little bit different. Now, I don't want to get into the conspiracy thing. Was it Oswald, or was it the CIA or the Mafia or all the very, you know, we've had 2 weeks of nonstop, you know, Kennedy dying endlessly on television.
And I had my blitz on the 22nd.
Yep. Don't want to go down that road. But what Jeff did in his novel, which was my takeoff point, he simply had the rain, which existed in Texas that day. Instead of the skies clearing in Dallas, so they didn't have the bubble top on the limo,
that's right,
the rain continued. And so Kennedy could not do the motorcade without the bubble top, and the bubble top foiled the assassination efforts. And with that one change of fate, like, you know, you could imagine, you know, you've heard of the concept of the butterfly effect, that a butterfly fluttering around in the Amazon changed the frontal pattern so the front didn't move through Dallas quick enough, so they had rain and they had to keep the top on. I mean, on those things does hang history. So if the plot was spoiled, if the shots missed, or Kennedy was just wounded and then recovered, and obviously, like Reagan, became an incredible national hero for surviving his assassination, then the novel that Greenfield has written goes through a first term and then a second term that would have allowed him to win against any opposition, Goldwater included, and he would have served 8 years, just like Obama is going to serve 8 years. So then the question is, what would he have done in terms of policy that would have made the history of planet Earth different?
Well, he wanted us to go to the moon, so that vision got us there.
Absolutely. Well, see, that's the thing that I find stunningly short-sighted among Greenfield and all the other copycats who basically, taking the lead off his book, have done all kinds of, you know, the Christian Science Monitor did a series, the Huffington Post did a series, What Would Life Have Been Like If Kennedy Had Lived? Every one of these folks, George, misses the obvious, which is, what was Kennedy going to do in space?
That's right.
Because the fight I had with Cronkite's people 40, almost 50 years ago now at CBS, which I'm still having today, as I'm seeing in these various extrapolations of if Kennedy had actually survived, none of the mainstream pundits or politicians or experts or commentators or historians, whatever, none of them, except for one writer I found a couple days ago, even makes mention of the space program and its pivotal, crucial importance to the future destiny of human beings all over the earth that John Kennedy, I can guarantee you, saw and would have made happen. And the reason I can say that with such certitude is because we have documentation, just like Greenfield used memos and historical documents and federal research contracts and results of Brookings studies and the Warren Commission and all that. I am basing my extrapolations not on just wishful thinking, but on what Kennedy did before he died, that he obviously, after the trauma of almost being killed and killed in that way, would have reinvigorated him to do in spades after he had survived.
Well, it would have brought up some very interesting possibilities, Richard.
Well, let me give you a couple specifics, and then we can take the last half hour to touch on details of anything you want to go back over.
All right.
We know from the record, from both the White House, from Sorensen's book called Counselor, you know who Ted Sorensen was.
Ted was.
He was basically Kennedy's alter ego. They wrote brilliant speeches together. They were like soul brothers. It was like Sorensen was Kennedy's voice and put such amazing energy and fervor and lilt into those speeches that encapsulated dull policy in a way that would ring down through history. So we've got his testimony.
But Sorensen, by the way, right, we choose to go to the moon, that speech.
Yep.
I bet he did.
Yep. He wrote most of them. In fact, he was the one who wrote the letter to Khrushchev that basically altered history and prevented World War III and the nuclear holocaust that would have ensued if Khrushchev had not been given an offer where he could back down gracefully and Kennedy could back down gracefully over the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Yeah, that's right, because our generals were going, Richard.
Believe me, Kennedy lived what Eisenhower warned about, which was the creeping monster of the military-industrial complex.
Yes.
That would turn the United States into the national security state that it is tonight. If Kennedy had lived, that probably would not have happened because Kennedy would have, A, realized that somebody was really out to get him, and it wasn't some lone idiot in the school book depository. He would have launched an investigation that would have rooted out who it was, would made it public. Things would have been so radically different because of that trauma and what he was on the mission he was on before he was killed. In fact, the reason he was killed, which Mike and I document in Dark Mission, is that he had consummated an agreement with Premier Khrushchev after years of wooing him.
Hold on for a second, Rich. We're at the bottom. We'll be back. Hey, do join us on our Thanksgiving night program. We're going to have a couple hours of open lines, and I'll be chatting with Brenda Knight about how Mothman influenced her career. And when we come back in a moment, more with Richard C. Hoagland, and we'll take some of your calls as well right here on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back, Richard Hoagland with us. Richard, so had Kennedy lived, as you mentioned, he would have gotten reelected. He would have taken himself up to 1968. I doubt if Nixon would have been elected afterwards. And, you know, we landed on the moon in 1969. Might he have been able to have speeded that up?
Well, remember, a lot of what goes on in space is dependent on money. If you pump more money into the system, you get a faster product. And there is an argument to be made that if he was after what I'm going to describe the next few minutes with Khrushchev, then he would have gone to the Congress, he would have made the case that we needed more money, and Von Braun could have produced the Saturn V sooner,
yes,
maybe by a couple of years. And it although he probably would not have been president during the actual landing, he certainly would have been president during the early testing of the technology, and with the help of the Soviets and some of their technology, because they had some interesting wrinkles that never really, you know, were able to be properly funded because of the dissension in the Soviet hierarchy. He might have just left office during, let's say, an Apollo 8 type mission. What I wanted to say before the break was we have incontrovertible evidence, both from Sorensen, from the historical record, from the documents from the National Archives, as well as the testimony of Chairman Khrushchev's surviving son, who's a professor at Brown University, who made these statements repeatedly, starting with a PBS special several years ago and has continued to stand by them, that about 10 days before Kennedy was killed, Khrushchev took his son on a walk in the garden of their dacha outside Moscow and told him he had decided to accept the president's offer made in September of 63 at the United Nations in a major speech that stunned an awful lot of people, where this cold warrior, this hawk, went from being a hawk to wanting to and beating the Soviet Union to the moon, to reaching out, you know, a hand and inviting Khrushchev and the Soviet cosmonauts to go with the Apollo astronauts to the moon together. And historically, no one except Mike and I in Dark Mission have made the background case as to why this stunning reversal, which on the face of it looks completely idiotic and crazy. I mean, if you have based an entire program funded we've got to beat the Russians, got to beat the Russians, got to beat the Russians, and suddenly you turn around and say, well, we're going to go with the Russians. Don't you think there would have been some opposition in the Congress to basically funding something like that?
Well, the opposition was probably the clandestine conspirators who killed him.
Exactly. And there's a whole, you know, Mike and I went through it in great length in Dark Mission, who those players were, and Johnson was one of them, and that's a, you know, I don't know whether you had Robert Stone on. Stone makes a really good case that LBJ, you know, was the guy behind at least some level of the conspiracy. I don't want to get bogged down on that. I want to talk about the future, because if Kennedy and Khrushchev had made the deal and Kennedy had been able to sell it, the only way he could have sold it is to have these guys in private briefings and shown them what there was waiting on the moon for us together to completely change history, prevent nuclear annihilation. Remember, we had just come through the terrible, awful, you know, nightmare of the Cuban Missile Crisis, where we came within a whisker of incinerating civilization, incinerating the planet. That seared both men's ideas about how they had to somehow get along. And this would have been the perfect foil over which to get along, particularly because we now know, based on our research and countless programs that I've done here on Coast, that there was stunning, amazing stuff waiting for us to jointly explore.
I agree.
And make public on the moon.
I agree.
Ancient,
I think,
extraterrestrial artifacts.
I think Khrushchev was beginning to soften up and like Kennedy, wasn't he?
Oh, no, he respected Kennedy after the missile thing, because it turned out he wasn't a spoiled brat of his daddy. He was a man who could think on his own, stand up to the general. Remember, the generals were all trying to get him into a war
and
with
reason.
Fidel Castro.
Yep.
And he refused to be stampeded, and he and Khrushchev did a little do-si-do to save the world.
But all those reasons cost him his life.
Well, because he was not prepared for needing to watch his six. If he had been attacked and survived Dallas, you can damn well bet he would have looked high and low for who was responsible and would not have settled for the lone gun nut in the sixth floor window of the school book depository there at Dealey Plaza. He'd already talked about breaking the CIA into a million pieces, which was one of the reasons why they were part of the plot. But let's not get diverted. I now know, based on hard evidence that I have personally acquired, that when Project Corona, which was begun as a satellite surveillance program by Dwight Eisenhower, the president previous to Kennedy in the 60s, there was a unmanned reconnaissance satellite program clandestinely put under the Discover satellite peaceful, scientific investigations as a diversionary cover to basically photograph the missile bases and the airfields and all the military accoutrements of the Soviet Union during the height of the Cold War.
That was with the U-2 program, right?
And they phased out U-2 when they were able to bring in the satellites under Project Corona. What you do not know, which I can tell this audience tonight, and which I've actually presented once in a public forum in Los Angeles about, I think, 5 years ago, is because we got the film. When Project Corona was initiated in the 1960s, in August of 1960, remember, Kennedy was killed in November of 63. There were several missions that flew in Earth orbit that were returned successfully, finally, and gave the president actual film of the Soviet Union from a reconnaissance satellite, the first of its kind under Project Corona, right?
Yep. Absolutely.
Okay. Except it turns out, because we got our hands on some of that film, actual film, and I cannot tell you how or what the paper trail was or whatever. We just know it's real. It's totally real. I've had it checked out by intelligence experts. It's real. The actual first successful missions of the Corona satellite program did not take test images of Soviet missile bases or Eastern Europe or airfields in the old, Russian Empire. Instead, we got a whole film can with thousands of exposures of images taken by that satellite of the moon. Now, why do you think a reconnaissance satellite program advertised eventually, because it was top secret at the time, but advertised inside the military-industrial complex as being a way to eavesdrop and look down on the Soviets and see where they ranked in terms of missile emplacements and their war footing and how many ICBMs they had compared to how many we had and all that, why would the test footage be not of those missile bases on Earth, but instead looking directly up overhead at the moon and taking countless pictures of the lunar surface from low Earth orbit and then recovering the film exactly like the film was recovered in Ice Station Zebra? That picture that Howard Hughes kept running over and over and over and over and over again until he died. And my answer is, it was what they saw on those pictures that convinced Kennedy there was something stunningly artificial and ancient technology visible even on that film from low Earth orbit in a vacuum that convinced him to finally make the pitch to Khrushchev, and for Khrushchev to finally say yes.
Yep.
And if all that were true, and Kennedy had survived, and we had gone to the moon together with the Soviet Union, the history of this planet would have been totally different, and the last 40-plus years would not have taken place. Vietnam would not have taken place. You wouldn't have had Iran. You wouldn't have had Iraq, rather. You wouldn't have had all the other problems that we've had. You would have had the United States as a constitutional republic opening the solar system and the wonders that have been left as an ancient legacy to the entire planet in cooperation with our bitterest enemies, and history would have totally changed. And this is what Greenfeld is missing.
It would have been dramatic. And you're right, he is missing that. Let's take a few calls in the few minutes we have left here, Richard. Let's go to Al, truck driving in Minnesota. Hi, Al. Go ahead.
Yeah, howdy. Hey, great show. Nice to talk to you there, Richard. Say, I got a question for you. Let's suppose ISON really isn't a comet. I've seen YouTube clips where people are kind of insinuating that. And years ago, I listened to a program that Art Bell had a guest, and that guest suggested that if it's a kind of a major comet, 3 leaders or monarchs die, and if it's kind of a minor comet, you have 2. And I started watching that, and back when Halley's Comet went by, I remember it was Pope John Paul died, and I can't remember the sequence because there was another comet shortly after that. If it was Mother Teresa and Yasser Arafat and the King of Jordan died, but I can't remember which ones died with, but if this would be a real comet, then if that holds true, shouldn't there be some leaders and monarchs die? Wouldn't that be the test to prove if it really is a comet? Or,
well, remember, that's all projection, because going back historically, when comets have appeared and bad things happen on the Earth, there's this association, you know, connected symbolically, ritually, that the celestial apparition, the celestial portents, the signs, foretold the bad things were going to happen. There's no real, you know, one-to-one correlation or connection. It's all psychological projection. What I'm talking about is a numerically provable pattern where someone is manipulating this object, and we call it a comet, but we don't really know that it's a natural object, i.e. a comet. It appears to be a setup for something happening on Earth that isn't negative, that in fact could be very positive. And we will know whether we're right or wrong on this over the next few weeks.
You know, there is some talk, you know, Hopi prophecy.
Exactly. It could be the so-called Blue Katrina.
That's right. That's right. Al, thanks for your call.
And if that's the case, if you read the Hopi prophecies very carefully, they don't talk about catastrophe, they talk about change. They talk about the Blue Katrina dropping its mask in the square during the ceremony. In other words, the end of cover-up, the beginning of truth, beginning of disclosure of something. So there's a lot of different ways to read these prophecies and these myths. But when you look at the numbers and you know that someone's manipulating something that could be so dramatic so that a lot of people pay attention, you got to ask the question, what is their objective?
Let's go to Don now, Knight's Landing in California. You're on with Richard Hoagland. Don, go ahead.
Hello, George and Richard.
Hello, Donald.
It's a privilege to speak to you. I wanted to mention something about when the night Obama's polls were coming in, the night of his first election, right? I saw this anomaly in the sky. It was a white line that began at the horizon, and it moved slowly across the sky from a 6 o'clock position to a noon position and then to another position. As it slowly disappeared, another one came, and I watched this happen the entire night, and I even called a friend who was about 30 miles away, and he observed the same phenomenon. And I still, to this day, I have no idea what that could have been. It was very strange.
Where were you located?
This was located here in Northern California, in the Sacramento Valley area.
Well, there's a lot of missile activity out of Point Magoo, north of Los Angeles, you know, where they fire test rockets out over the Pacific. It sounds like some kind of contrail to me, but it could have been high altitude aircraft. It could have been satellites. Again, that's not comparable to what could happen with this object, given the numbers and the dates that it's kind of, you know, projecting against.
Richard, what was your reaction to our guest talking about chemtrails?
Well, I think he's right on, and I love the idea that he's got an app that can democratize, you know, people observing from all over the world and kind of get a global sense of where, what's doing what when. The one thing that I thought was missing from his discussion is that there is a NASA patent, and that a friend of ours, Mike Castle, found it many, many years ago out of NASA Lewis, when it actually talked about global climate modification using high-altitude dispersal of aerosols from jet aircraft, jet transport aircraft, to basically keep the surface of the planet cool as the sun warms in a long-term solar cycle. And I'm kind of surprised that he doesn't realize that that's probably what we're all looking at. And that, again, like with everything else, including the HAARP project, there's a lot of disinformation designed to lead people away from the actual facts of what they're doing, because they don't want to admit that the sun could be doing things that are out of our control, and that they would have to, you know, basically, you know, go to these somewhat desperate measures to try to keep the climate, you know, moderately livable for the foreseeable future.
Did you get hit with any bad weather out in your neck of the woods, Albuquerque?
Well, we had a snowstorm that briefly came through. It's now been stunningly crystal clear, and people are talking about how they can't see blue skies. We have gorgeous blue skies. Everybody come on down to see blue skies in New Mexico.
Is it cold?
And temperatures up in the low 60s, upper 50s during the daytime.
Richard, we've got a minute left. Any speaking engagements for you? Anything you want to tell the Coast listeners?
Well, I've got an announcement that's not a speaking gig exactly. It's something that I've been working on for a long time, and I'm hoping that it will come to fruition. So when we do our next show, which will not be several months away, I'll be able to announce it and all the implications, because I'm going to want to involve the Coast audience. I can tell you that it will be pretty spectacular if it works, and we may have some more ammunition in terms of what ISON could do in the next few weeks. At the very least, I'm going to be working on these papers. I'm going to finish up the Curiosity series on what they really found on Mars, which if you go to the Coast website, just look at the images and tell me those things are just rocks, because they ain't. And in terms of the Kennedy thing, the more I got into this, the more I got enchanted with the idea that Kennedy really would have used his rapprochement with Khrushchev to change the world from facing nuclear confrontation to where all the bugaboos and all the horrible things that have happened and continue to face us over the last 50 years and the next decades would not have happened. History would have taken.
No, you are absolutely right. Richard, thank you so much. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesour, Stephanie Smith, Chris Boros, George Knapp, John B. Wells, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie. Somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM, we'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.